Welcome to this LSE Ideas event, which we are very happy and pleased to have organized with the Polish Culture Institute here in London. The topic and the title we're going to look at today is Visegrad countries in the global order. As I'm sure many of you know, this is now the 30th anniversary of the foundation of the Visegrad 4, or the V4, V3 then, before Czechoslovakia separated, on the 15th of February 1991. So we're delighted to be discussing something that, which I think many people in the Western part of Europe and the UK need to know a lot more about, and hopefully this particular discussion we're going to have between our five experts from the four different countries and one person from the UK will, I think, bring us right up to date on some of the key questions. We're going to run in the order which I've got in front of me. And the first speaker, and I'll introduce everybody quickly now. We've got an hour and a half, so we've got plenty of time. The first speaker will be Vladimir Bilčík, a member of the European Parliament from Slovakia, working on civil liberties, EU foreign policy, and it serves in the European People's Party spokesperson for foreign interferences and disinformation. Welcome, Vladimir. Our second speaker will be Peter Balázs, who's professor emeritus at the Central European University in Budapest in Hungary. He is a former foreign minister of Hungary between 2009 and 2010, and a former European commissioner back in 2004. Then we have Jacek Sajusz-Wolski, a former Polish Europe minister and EU membership negotiator, and a veteran EP member who is working on foreign affairs and energy security fields. Welcome to Jacek from Poland. Alison Smale, who is a veteran British journalist who's worked on Central Europe throughout the 1990s. And last but by no means the least, Michael Jantowski, a Czech diplomat, politician and author who's one of the founding members of the Civic Forum during the Velvet Revolution in 1989. He's also a former ambassador of the Czech Republic to the UK, Israel and the US. So a very distinguished speaker. Each of the speakers will take 5 minutes. I'm not going to tell you what they're going to say. Each will in turn introduce what they want to say, beginning with Vladimir, moving on to Peter. We will leave all the Q&A to the end, if we could. Please send in your questions and answers. I shall try and process those as quickly and as speedily and as efficiently as possible and as fairly as possible so that we can have plenty of questions and plenty of answers at the end, because no point just asking a lot of questions if you don't get the answers. So I'm just going to hand over straight away to Vladimir to begin. I'm going to give 5 minutes to each of our five speakers, 5-6 minutes, and then I'll ask a couple of questions and then we'll move into the Q&A. So Vladimir from Slovakia, no more ado. We're really looking forward to what you have to say, and welcome to this event.
Thank you very much, Michael, and very good late afternoon from Brussels, from the European Parliament. And it's a real pleasure to be a part of this session. I want to thank the LSE, the organizers putting this together, the Polish Cultural Institute, but also all the V4 diplomats who I know have been engaged in helping to put this together. It's a real timely opportunity. The V4 has been around for 30 years, and I do hope we will have a lively and an important European future in the V4 for the next 3 decades. This would be really a very good bit of news. I'm also very grateful to the LSE for doing this. I was last time in London at the LSE as an academic, as a researcher, actually within the LSE Ideas project, discussing Brexit before Brexit. Despite Brexit, I'm very happy that the exchange of ideas and on Europe is still very much kicking and alive across the English Channel. And I think this is important. We need as much cooperation now, and this is an important important moment to also discuss Central European recent history and the V4 itself. Now, I am a member of the European Parliament, have been here since 2019, but I spent most of my professional life as an academic, as an analyst, working on foreign policy, Central European politics, issues of EU enlargement, and of course, V4 has been an important part of all this. Let me start in this few minutes which I have by saying that what is the essence of the Visegrad identity? What is the essence of the V4? And when I look back at the last 30 years, I mean, the raison d'etre of the whole arrangement has been to work together on a meaningful return to Europe after communism. This was the foundation of the V3 back in 1991. And I think it's been a real success story in terms of getting Central Europe, post-communist Central Europe, back to Europe, back to the European Union, where I think it could have been and should have been had it not been for the Iron Curtain. Of course, to NATO, which is the anchor of our security and continues to be. And of course, to all the major international institutions and getting us also back to Europe when it comes to the essential values, values of democracy, freedom, fundamental rights, and their protection. In a real sum, this has been a huge achievement. And it's been especially a huge achievement in terms of my country, Slovakia, which is the youngest member of the V4, independent since 1993, following a very peaceful and in the end amicable dissolution of Czechoslovakia and the divorce which took place back then. I still, as somebody who was born in Czechoslovakia, very much have strong ties and strong connection to this entity. And here in the European Parliament, we actually have a common Czech and Slovak or Czechoslovak delegation in my political group, the European People's Party group. So we work very closely together with our Czech friends and colleagues. So I think there is a very special Czechoslovak connection, which continues to date in the V4. And why am I mentioning the Slovak example? It is because I think it illustrates very well that V4 has played a crucial role, given the difficulties we had back in the 1990s with the Slovak path to Europe, to the European Union and to NATO. Unfortunately, due to an authoritarian regime, which was personified by our Prime Minister Vladimir Mečiar in the 1990s, Slovakia was left out from the first wave of NATO enlargement in 1997. And of course, we also lost the train of opening accession negotiations in Luxembourg back in 1997, the same year. And we were able to catch up with our Visegrad neighbors and join the European Union together in 2004 in no small bit thanks to the V4, thanks to V4 cooperation politically, geopolitically, but also very practically. We were able to catch up in accession negotiations with the EU member states, EU institutions. So V4 has really served as a vehicle of cooperation, really fulfilling the goal of the successful return to Europe. And what has it done since we joined the European Union? Of sentences on this, because I think this is important. V4 is not a firm club. It is a firm foundation. Firm foundation for dialogue, for communication, for exchange of views, and for trying to find common positions on whatever we can to pursue together at the level of the European Union. Of course, we are in different institutional positions in the V4. Slovakia has joined Schengen, but also the Eurozone. It is the only Eurozone country in the V4. So I would very much hope that one day the whole of V4 could actually be in the Eurozone. I know this is a political and a legal and an economic decision and not an easy one, but it would be very helpful for the political cohesion of the whole region. But we have our differences, we acknowledge them, but we exchange very, very openly on these, on all fora, across the governments, also here with within the European Parliament, and also in the civil society. I think it's important to say that the V4 is not an institutionalized entity, with the exception of the International Visegrad Fund, which is an entity which funds joint projects, supports the civil society, but politically it has stayed a rather loose network. Yet, it has achieved quite a prominence as a trademark. Now, unfortunately, let me say this, this trademark has had some mixed images as of recent years, marked especially by the events following the big migration crisis across the European Union, and also following some political differences, which we have between Poland and Hungary on the one hand, and Slovakia and the Czech Republic on the other hand. However, I do believe that just like V4 has had a some bumpy times and a bumpy road to this 30th anniversary, we will certainly work towards a European future of the V4, because it makes us all stronger collectively. If we can in a meaningful way contribute to the future foundation of the European Union, the V4 will be strong. Not a single member of a state of the V4 can perform this alone. So V4 is and continues to be very useful. But of course, we also look at coalitions with other member states and cooperation within other fora in Europe. This is not the exclusive club. We use it when it works. And I hope it can work even better for the benefit of all of us. So I would leave it here. I think I've exceeded my 5 minutes. I do apologize. I hope we can have more of an exchange during the Q&A. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Vladimir. A very nice introduction. And we move straight over to Peter Balázs. Peter, over to you.
Good afternoon and welcome, everybody. I'm speaking from Budapest, a few kilometers distance from the place where the Visegrad Declaration was signed 30 years ago, in the icy cold ruins of a medieval castle, commemorating the first alliance in 30 and 35 among the participants. The interesting thing is that Visegrad could resist all the changes across those 30 years, systemic change, NATO and EU accessions, parliamentary elections, government changes in the four countries, and V4 is still there. This is perhaps the reverse cohesion, because usually when we get a smaller group within a larger organization like NATO or EU, it is more cohesive, it is stronger inside than the larger framework, like Benelux, like the political cohesion of the Nordic countries, and several others. The specificity of Visegrad is that Visegrad is a looser structure than the bigger frameworks. There are definitely more rights and obligations from the EU membership, from NATO membership, and so on, and still this is working. The four members is an ideal size for cooperation. This is direct and flexible, we have resisted to the temptation of enlargement of these four member group across the 30 years. There were several requests, several offers from the outside, but our conviction was that the four-wheel drive is the best construction for passing all the difficulties. However, we have established several contacts with other groups. When I happened to be in the chair of Visegrad in my government function, we had meetings between Visegrad and the three Baltics, between Visegrad and the three Benelux, between Visegrad and the EU trio presidency of that time. And those meetings proved to be very useful. Now, the problem with the four is that with four members, there is no majority. This is either two are starting and the two other follows, because the majority, there is only one majority, three against one. And this is politically not a good solution. So usually when two governments start doing something or targeting something, the question is whether the two others will follow. We have a lot of common interests. I'm not going deeply back in history, but these were the nations that stood up against the Soviet rule during those times. We have a very similar economic development level. And our common interests are mainly based on structures that are territorially bound, like transport, energy, environment, employment, and several others. For that reason, the stronger common positions can be formed within the European Union, much more than in any other organization. And we have already cooperated during the accession negotiations. We were the four last countries. I was there in Copenhagen in December 2002 when we concluded the negotiations. And this was the hardcore of that big team that joined the EU. By that time, the four prime ministers were sitting around one single table in the buffet and coordinated their positions. The question is whether Visegrad will survive the next 30 years. In my feeling, this is a good structure. The content depends always on what the actual governments want to do. If they can find a common denominator, they will cooperate. But I have the feeling that we should be better organized, better mandated, better staffed, and better financed. Visegrad would merit more attention. The question is who and when could do it, because there was only one miraculous moment in history when we had, by that time, three wonderful presidents, Václav Havel, Lech Wałęsa, and Arpad Gönc. I cannot see the successors of those three presidents today. Thank you.
Peter, thank you very much for those comments, looking forward as well as looking backwards. What will the next 30 years bring? We'll have to discuss that, I think. And the third speaker, Jacek, I'm passing over to you now. Jacek.
Thank you so much. I could fully subscribe to what was said by my Slovak and, sorry, Czech and Hungarian predecessors. So just a few complimentary words. Born 30 years ago, I was at his birth, the second summit in Krakow in 91, in Prague when we jointly launched the Eastern Partnership, and when we signed in 1991 in December jointly, three prime ministers then, the association agreement. But it will be difficult to understand the cohesion of the group, which is bigger than it appears to be, if you do not remind that it is 8 centuries old. We share the same history, we share the same cultural affinity, we share the same interests, and we happen to share the same sovereigns, I mean kings. We had the same kings coming either from Budapest or from Prague or from Krakow. So it's a 14th century old community of destiny. We fought against southern and eastern pressures and military invasions, be it Turks or Russians. And also we have been special in a sense of being Europe's anti-Christian, anti-muralis. I mean, the wall of to defend the Christianity in Europe. So a lot of common. It is very true what Milan Kundera said. It is the essence for understanding of Central Europe. When he wrote his Tragedy of Central Europe, or the French title, Un Occident kidnappé à la tragédie, ou la tragédie de l'Europe centrale. The tragedy of Central Europe was that it was politically East in the recent decades before the big change, and culturally, in terms of identity, it was West, and it was kidnapped in 1945. And this fundamental identity feature unites us and will keep us united for long. What is the uniting factor also is that V4 plays a role of a core for wider community of Central East European states, which now is called Three Seas, initiative. They share the same problems, frustrations, and feelings, be it or fearing the second category membership in NATO or EU. We also share, irrespective of who governs in Prague, Budapest, or Warsaw, to a great extent, the traditional values, and whether socialists, liberals, or center-right, even liberals and socialists in Visegrad countries are conservative, I would say. And we are jointly vaccinated against left and right totalitarianism and extremists. So shared identity, interests, and specificity, deeper than political differences, bode well for the future of V4 and Central Eastern Europe core. Because the question of this webinar is what a role in the global order, I mean, geopolitics. So I would say that in EU jointly we are stronger, working on a sub-regional integration, not a temporary alliance like Benelux, but a deep-rooted cultural identity-based alliance, becoming more visible and influential over time, although having differences and although having weaker and better times. We jointly share the same views on necessity to integrate the wider region, three seas, or three marium. Second, the consolidation of the eastern flank of EU and NATO. Third, eastern neighborhood policy robust and efficient. Fourth, Russia policy, whatever may be behind it. Five, China policy, being born, I mean, the new phenomenon. Six, NATO policy. And seven, last but not least, EU policy. There are always pre-summit V4 summits. There is rotating presidency. It is institutionalized. I have here to disagree with the previous speaker. It has a secretariat and fund. We are very often, if you analyze the votes in the European Parliament, voting together, very often across the political divisions. I've been organizing V4 joint initiatives. We have the same view of the market forces within the EU rather than interventionist economic policy. We are attached to the similar degree to Euro-Atlantic vision of the global order. And we pay special attention to our eastern neighborhood. So together, I would say that its cohesion is raising, and also its influence will be raising, because the objective parameters of our past and present joint interests and identity indicate that it would go into that direction. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Jacek. That's very interesting. I move on straight away to Alison. Alison Smail, you are mute at the moment, Alison. Can you hear me? Alison?
There you go.
Hi, we can't see you, but we can hear you, Alison.
Yes, well, unfortunately, I don't.
Don't worry about that. As long as you've got a good, strong voice, that's excellent.
Okay, we will try.
Good.
So, I mean, it's actually fascinating to have been invited to take part in this discussion, for which I am very thankful. And because it gave me a chance to go back over things that had happened since early 1990s, when Central and Eastern Europe were taking shape and everybody was trying to adjust to the new reality of no physical Iron Curtain after a while and so on. What has been said in this discussion so far certainly makes clear that there is a high degree of coordination if one seeks it. And that, as ever, groups like those that have sprung up around the Three Seas Agreement are diplomatic gatherings that can serve as very good listening posts for what are the potential problems on the horizon, or a good way to fix a problem that's been around for a while. What I think is interesting as an outside observer is the way that it's possible to use the Visegrad countries and the other ones attached in organizations like 3Cs. It's possible to use them as illustrations of possibilities. One doesn't risk too much by discussing why don't we have more to do with, let's say, Ukraine. But there is a way, there's a framework in which this can be put. And I think that is the value of the vision that somebody mentioned, the three presidents, Václav Havel, Arpad Grunz, Lech Wałęsa. They were three pretty exceptional men, and they enabled Central and Eastern Europe to emerge as relatively peacefully as it did in the late 1990s. And those are lessons that can be applied now. I wonder, and I'd be interested to hear from those of you who teach students, how much awareness there is outside foreign policy circles of the kinds of organizations that Visegrad and others have been able to fuel and to foster. I wonder also if there's, I often wonder this about a lot of European structures, you know, how genuinely popular and needed are they? How much explanation really goes into them? But one thing I did notice, and I will be then shut up, when I was at the United Nations for 2 years, 2017 to 2019, Slovakia played a fairly outsized role just because it had the rotating chairmanship for a year. And it was a very wonderful way to introduce people who really would never have a chance to even think about Slovakia to the traditions and the customs of that particular country. But I really wonder if anybody back home in Slovakia would be able to sort of stack that up as a, you know, here's what we scored and here's what we gained from introducing our country more thoroughly. I will stop there since I think, I'm sure Michal has much more interesting things to say about how much it has been possible to realize the vision of those three visionary presidents and where the way forward lies. So thank you very much for your attention, and I look forward to a lively discussion.
Thank you very much, Alison. I'll come back later on how much awareness there is, at least where I'm sitting here in London and maybe in some of the other Western countries like France and Germany. If I'm honest about it, in terms of, say, Britain, the awareness is not very high amongst students, but certainly would be amongst politicians in the UK, I think, especially maybe after Brexit itself, because the relationships between the V4 and Brexit, it become even more significant.
Yes. But
we'll come back to that again, but it's a very, very good question. We think we're always in something that everybody else is interested in and knows a lot about, but maybe not. That's, you know, we know that problem from teaching over many years. But anyway, thanks very much, Alison, for those few comments, but very useful ones as well. And last but by no means least, Michal Jantowski. Michal.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. As a chronologically challenged person, I was assigned a task to revisit some of the beginnings of the V4. As all living organisms, the Visegrad Group has its prehistory, its history, and its present. It was first contemplated, at least as far as I know, in Warsaw in January 1990. It was conceived in Bratislava in April 1990. And to satisfy the need for proper alliteration, it was con-celebrated in Budapest and Visegrad on 15th of February 1991. It had many Polish, Hungarian, and Czech and Slovak godfathers, many of them old friends and fellow freedom fighters from the communist days. But it is fair to say that Václav Havel was its spiritual father. And I had the privilege to be present in all the three places. In his speech to the Polish Sejm and Senate on the 25th of January 1990, the newly elected Czechoslovak president told the audience, I quote, "We have an opportunity to transform Central Europe, which has so far been a largely historical and cultural phenomenon, into a political phenomenon, a specific entity which will approach the more prosperous Western Europe, not just as a poor relative or a helplessly confused amnestied prisoner, but as someone who aims to contribute something as well, namely spiritual and moral stimuli, the so far unutilized creative potential, the ethos of the newfound freedom, and the inspiration for bold and swift solutions," unquote. In the speech, he invited the Polish and Hungarian representatives to meet in the near future at the castle in Bratislava to discuss the idea. And the next day after the speech, he traveled to Budapest to spread the gospel. The April meeting in Bratislava gave the idea of a regional grouping and its goals some firmer contours. In fact, the Visegrad group might have been born that day if it were not for a question of legitimacy. Whereas Hungary and Czechoslovakia were represented by the newly elected symbols of democratic transformation in Central Europe, Josef Antal and Václav Havel, in Poland, Lech Wałęsa was still waiting in the wings, and the country was represented by General Jaruzelski, hardly a promising sign of a democratic future. So the group was conceived in Bratislava, but had to wait to be born a little more than 9 months later in Hungary. The Visegrad Declaration is somewhat short on specifics, but its title conveys the general idea precisely. It is called Declaration on Cooperation in Striving for European Integration. It emphasized not only the geographic and cultural proximity, but also the universal values that bound the three countries together, namely, and I quote, "mutual tolerance and respect for individual families, local, regional, and national communities, and the freedom from hatred, nationalism, xenophobia, and local strife," unquote. We can all reflect on how true we stayed to these goals and how successful we were in fulfilling Havel's ambitions. It is also worth noting what Visegrad was not. It was not an embryonal security concept aiming at the integration into NATO, as sometimes claimed, and there is little in the declaration itself to suggest it. And the reason was quite simple. The Warsaw Pact was officially disbanded only on the 1st of July, 1991, and there were still Soviet troops on the territory of the three countries. It may have been in the back of our minds, but it was better left unsaid. How have the ambitions of the group fared so far? Not as well as we hoped and not as poorly as we feared. The fundamental cooperation is benefiting all the countries, all the four countries to this day, in the spheres of cultural and civil society ties and cooperation exemplified by the Visegrad Fund, we have fared extremely well. We all joined the EU at the same time in 2004. My personal regret is that we were unable to properly coordinate our accession negotiations and their strategies. If we had negotiated together, we might have obtained better terms. Over the years, there have been various more or less justified complaints and criticisms of the group as poorly coordinated, ineffective, counterproductive, or downright chaotic. In my mind, we have resembled nothing more than a class of students brought together by common destiny and aspirations. There has always been a star pupil among us, and occasionally a black sheep that people like to single out. The interesting thing is that the individual roles kept changing. You know, we were all black sheeps and star pupils at different times. So 30 years later, we have a shared story to look back on with some pride. We still like each other, and we still have homework to do, just like everybody else. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael, for those comments. We've got lots of questions coming through, but I think I'll maybe throw out a general question. You obviously emphasized, and quite rightly, many of the positives, the fact that you're still together, the fact that you can coordinate such the Czech Republic and Slovakia. There are clearly differences between you. Maybe, if you don't mind, I'd kind of tease some of those differences out a little bit, if I could, to generate a discussion. If not an argument, I hope not. One is about the degree of difference between the countries as much as the unity between them. And as you know, within Western countries and elsewhere, there's certainly been a criticism, particularly of Hungary and certainly of Poland, as to whether or not those two countries, at least under current governments, have departed from what some would call European values in some regard and in some ways. Now, that's not my point, but that is a point that has been made by various critics. You know that as well as I do. You hear it more frequently than I do, and no doubt have to deal with that challenge all the time. So is that true? B, what does one mean by European values, I suppose? And moreover, even if there are these kinds of differences, how is it you then manage to still stick together, if I might ask you? It's a long question, but you know what I'm trying to get at. Vladimir, why don't I come back to you, because you went first and we haven't heard your voice for a very long time, and then go on to Peter. Not everybody has to answer that, but I thought I'd throw that one out first. Vladimir, over to you.
Thank you very much. No, this is a very good discussion, a very good exchange. And let me just make this clear. I think the Visegrad 4 back in the 1990s had a fundamental strategic goal. It was a political, it was a geopolitical goal. It was an existential goal for our region, for the three countries initially, and then the four countries. And that goal was successfully fulfilled in 2004 by joining the European Union, but earlier through NATO enlargement for the three countries. And I think this was the biggest single goal which we had in the history of the V4. And that made us successful. It also made us an attractive beacon. I remember the times when we had huge and countless discussions about enlarging the V4. Slovenia wanted to join, Lithuania wanted to join. We had a number of countries which were keen to join us. We always said three was a very nice number. We also like four, but we certainly would like to stick to four. And that's always been the V4 approach. And I understand why. We also had discussions with the Austrians at one point. They eventually thought that this might be a good idea after the European Union enlargement in 2004. So this was really the biggest single achievement. And of course, we had a number of strategic discussions politically in the V4 since the 2004 enlargement. What do we do together in the European Union? What do we do together in NATO? My colleague Jacek Szarzewski mentioned a number of things which I think are the strategic goals which we ought to focus on, such as the Eastern Partnership situation in Ukraine, Belarus, Moldova. But of course, I am very keenly engaged in the Western Balkans, for instance. I think European Union enlargement is something that the V4 should push even more. But quite frankly, it has become a very useful political tool for dialogue, for cooperation, for frank exchange of views. But it hasn't had such a big single goal since really the 1990s, when the goal was to come back to Europe and join these clubs. Also, and let's be honest here, and here I would disagree somewhat with my colleague from the European Parliament, we do have political differences across the V4, and who governs matters. And we see that V4 in very different terms. And I certainly would not agree that, everybody is a conservative who is in politics in Central Europe. No, that's not true. I think we are building a European democracy in Central Europe. And I think this is something which we need to build and create space for everybody to have full representation. And of course, these political differences then reflect on what the V4 can achieve and cannot achieve. It's an important vehicle in the European Union for important discussions, and it makes a difference when four countries can discuss things, can even come to a common joint strategic position in a club of 27. So for Slovakia, for instance, in terms of power, this is crucial. We are the smallest element. These are not just, chit-chats we have as politicians. They actually do matter, because if we can bring together a serious position when we discuss, for instance, financial arrangements, when we discuss also a cohesion policy, for instance, where the EU money should go and where it should be spent. This is, I think, where we can be united strongly, despite political differences we may have at the moment. So there are still some strategic interests. But I'd argue what holds us together is the fact that we've actually been in the European Union. And I think what could hold us more together in the future, and this is where I return to my original point, is if we were even more anchored in the European Union. Slovakia is in the Eurozone. We joined the Eurozone, and that makes a political difference in terms of also our access to certain institutional debates and decision-making processes. And it would be wonderful if Euro became a currency of the V4 as well. This is my wish. It's a political preference. I know it's not in my hands, and I also know that the tectonic forces are not for it at the moment, but I think it would be also enormously helpful. And of course, I think we need to get back to the basics. That's my last point. Today in the European Parliament, we had a big debate. I took part of it just before our discussion here on the freedom of media in Central Europe, especially. I think this has been something which has been challenged. In my country in particular, which saw a murder of an investigative journalist a couple of years ago, Jan Kuciak, but also when we look at the ranking of the freedom of media across Central Europe, we've seen a significant drop in all countries. And I think this is where we have a challenge. So I think I also see, and this is where I see an important role for both politicians, but also the civil society through the International Visegrad Fund. I think V4 should be here as the beacon of the fundamental values and the goals upon which it was founded, and those goals really had to do not only with a return to Europe, but also a firm place in Europe. And I hope this is what can help us. I think this really is important, and we can make a difference in the politics of the European Union if we are clear on what we stand for. But it doesn't happen very often these days.
Okay, Peter, do you want to have a little go at that one?
Well, let me start by saying that the four nations, we know each other and we like each other. That is a very special relationship between Hungarians and Slovaks. Hungary has today seven neighbors, seven nations, and the closest relationship is with the Slovaks. We feel like brothers. If we put aside some bad nationalist influences on both sides, some heritage, then we can really talk with each other. There's a special love with Poles, Hungarians, Poles, the two brothers, and a lot of common history, and very good relations, very open relations with the Czechs. So governments should not destroy that very positive relationship between and among the four nations. So far, we have survived all the governments in the last 30 years, and they obeyed that positive feeling between and among the four nations. There were some political tests. Interestingly enough, recently, the four government parties were in four different political families in the European Parliament. The Slovaks, the Smer party was with the socialists, the Fidesz party of Hungary so far was with the People's Party, the Polish party, PiS with European conservatives and reformists, and the Czech party with the liberals. And this was not an obstacle for doing things together. Now, unfortunately, there are still some divisions today, and it's true that the actual governments of Poland and Hungary are going one way and distancing to some extent from the two others. These are the two countries, and I cannot really understand why the two former pioneers, which gave the name to the FAR program, it was named from Poland-Hungary, PH, only from the two countries, and then extended to others. So why they made this U-turn, distancing from the original objectives of the Visegrad Cooperation and their original targets, and opting for this kind of sovereignist, nationalist drive, We have analyzed in my academic job, we made a lot of analysis why those two challenged Article 7 of the EU treaty and why not the other two. So what is the reason? We have a lot of explanations. We haven't got the time to deepen it. However, even between the two brothers, Poles and Hungarians, there is a dividing line, the relationship to Russia. The Hungarian prime minister's closest friend is Vladimir Putin, who came every year to Hungary. There was a year when he came twice to Budapest. And this foreign policy orientation is not fully approved by the population in Hungary. So we have some very serious reserves based on historical experience with our Russian second neighbors. And we are very cautious with any deal with the Russians. Jozsef Antal said after the big systemic change 30 years ago that we are tending a friendly hand, but please go home from our country and we are going to do good business with you, but not more. Good business. Okay, so I think that there are some problems, and a good foreign policy can overbridge actual and temporary political differences, not mixing up relations between political parties and states and nations.
Thanks very much. There's a lot to discuss there. Rather than go through everybody, I'm going to kind of direct a question now. It comes from an old friend, a colleague, who was with us in LSE Ideas, who's now at Sciences Po in France, David Cadieux. Nice to hear you, David, on the Q&A there. And it really picks up, and this is why I'm jumping in here, and I'll pass this over maybe to our Polish colleague, Jacek, about the divisions between Poland, because you touched on this very briefly there, Peter, on the divisions between Hungary and Poland on Russia. Again, looking at it from afar, but not just from afar, you can see it quite clearly. There's a very, very profound difference, I would have thought, on how to relate to Russia, and not just in general terms, but also in terms of EU sanctions on NATO and Ukraine, how to deal even the Sputnik vaccine itself. So are these just minor differences that you can override because you want to all stay together? Or are these such profound differences? Maybe if I went over to Jacek first from Poland, if you're listening to me, Jacek, thank you very much. And maybe, Peter, I'll come back to you because I've got other questions for others, including Michael. But maybe we could deal with that one first, Jacek, if you don't mind. The Poland-Hungary divide, as it is clearly seen by many from outside, including our good friend David Cadieux from Paris. Now, Jacek, over to you. Maybe
yes, but before answering directly the question, let me say I wanted and I want to refuse the temptation, which Peter, my colleague, did not, to accentuate the differences. Mm-hmm. If we were so homogenic as we all or they would wish, we would be United Kingdom of Visegrad. I don't think the differences between us are bigger than between Wales, England, and Scotland, not to mention Northern Ireland. Although we do not create a joint state. Although if the dynastic history went different, we might have been. There was a proposal in 39 to create a joint Polish-Czechoslovak state when we are already under German invasion. The talks were held in Eastern France, in Western France. So there were various, and we shared the same kings, as I said, and so forth. So we are quite cohesive, I would say more than Benelux. More in terms of deep interest than Franco-German tandem. There are things which are different, because if not, we would be one state. So we are looking for common goals and common interests. I would say, and counter to what was just said by why of my colleagues. I mean, but just to mention Peter Balázs, I worked with him on EU integration in early 90s, we jointly negotiated, we jointly signed association agreement in the Antoine Schumann building. I didn't even know what is his political affinity. I didn't care. We shared the same values, I mean, goals of joining EU. And now we continue, and this is the experience of the four prime ministers, we continue to fight together for the same interests in EU, cohesion, budget, Eastern neighborhood, Euro-Atlantic.
What about the policy? Let me come back to my original question, though.
Yeah.
Question of Russia, if you could pick that up as well from David Gadier. Thanks.
Yes, we differ with Hungary. We can live with it. Somebody who know the history of Hungary and 1956, when there were trains full of Hungarians coming to us and deliveries of blood from Poland to Hungary, somebody who know what was 56 in Budapest will never believe in this complot, Hungaro-Russian. It is a tactical move. I know closely Viktor Orban. I was angry at him. But it is a tactic thing. Mm. It is not a strategic thing. And because it is so, it does not divide us. Mm. It does not divide us. Remember, Hungary is a country victim of Trianon, victim historically of pressures from Turkey, 500 years of occupation, Russia. We have been fighting with them Turks together, and Germany. So special relationship with Ankara, Moscow, and Berlin is the credo of every government, be it socialist, liberal, or conservative in Hungary. And we accept it. So it is not a dividing line. But on Eastern Partnership, for example, we want to have strong, free as possible Eastern neighborhood. Yeah. We work together. But on the main lines of EU policy, we speak with the one voice, irrespective, as rightly Peter Balazs said. You did. I mean, every prime minister came from another political family, socialists, liberals, Christian Democrats, and conservatives. Mm. And we worked together. And being for 8 years in the government and negotiating various issues, I rarely even noticed or felt that this different belonging makes difference.
Yeah.
Not really. It's about and about values, let me say. First, backsliding on democracy, just two words, is untrue. In traditional values, we are very close. On this novel, so-called European values, not. But on major strategic choices, we are very, very close. And that leads me to this global question which you ask, because we tackle too much the internal V4 things. Uniting factors make us an actor within the EU, on the eastern flank of NATO, and in wider Europe. And this is consolidating. I mean, Visegrad is more and more influential and visible, while the Western Europe is more and more divided. There are countering vectors on those both sides. Thank you.
Thank you very much, very much. Interesting point you made there. You think that Orban's policy towards Russia is largely tactical, not strategic. That's a very important point. Peter, do you want to come in on that? And then I've got a lot more questions. I'll bring everybody in. Michael hasn't spoken for a little while. Peter, why don't you come in on...
Well, if you listen to the Hungarian media and Prime Minister Viktor Orban, you have daily... bad messages to the address of Brussels and hot, friendly, love messages to the address of Moscow. And not only Moscow, but Kazakhstan, China, Turkey. Orban likes very much Bolsonaro in Brasilia. He was the only European leader who attended and his entry into office, even with the Philippines, Duterte, there are relations. These are not approved by the majority of the Hungarian population. So I have to maintain my critiques, and there are several actions, not only words, actions, the attitude of Hungary towards Ukraine, doing everything in order to take Ukraine at a distance from NATO, and this serves Russian interests, or the a minor fact when Hungary was for the first time in the chair of the European of the Council of the EU, Orbán didn't want to host the summit meeting, the second summit meeting of the Eastern Partnership, and left it to Poland. It looked like a gesture. In reality, it was not to host something which is not with what Putin doesn't like. So they discussed it between them, and then Orbán gave it to the Polish government. And there are several minor things, but the major problem is the basic attitude challenging Article 7 within the EU. This is a question, why? And the recent event was expelling Fidesz from the EPP. So EPP said finally that enough is enough, and Fidesz was suspended 2 years ago. And now there is a situation that maybe Fidesz will leave EPP. Be careful, because whatever party family he joins, he will destroy it. His kiss is lethal. So it's a message to the address of other
board. Okay. I think we got that one loud and clear, Peter. I was going to come back to Jacek on the United Kingdom, by the way, because at the moment, Jacek, United Kingdom is not looking too, it doesn't feel too united at the moment. We'll come back on that. Michael, I'm aware and sensitive that I haven't brought you into the conversation. Is there anything you want to add to anything you've heard so far from your colleagues?
Well, yes. I think, you know, what unites us and geopolitically is the present, the obvious common interests we have, rather than the past 30 years later. You know, if we compare our victim credentials, I don't think we will get very far in building cohesion. But we do have shared interests, and some of them are interests vis-a-vis other countries like Russia in particular. I mean, that is Russia is, or the Soviet Union in one of its incarnations, is a omnipresent and a little traumatic factor in our country. So I would tend to agree with Jacek that Orbán's posturing towards Putin is more of a tactical nature, but that the popular attitudes of Hungarians towards Russia and the challenges it presents to all of us is very similar to that of Czechs and Slovaks and the Poles. So some of the differences are real. You know, I would not underestimate some of the, or I would criticize some of the steps Orbán took on the media, on kicking the Central European University out of Budapest, and I mean he's a self-proclaimed prophet of illiberal democracy, as it's called. So we should take him at his word. With Poland, we do have also differences, but they are differences of political ideology. The Polish government and the Polish society is more conservative, and I say conservative as a neutral term, not as a pejorative term, than the Czech society, which tends to be more liberal, again a descriptive term only. And last thing I would like to say is not to overestimate or overvalue the differences. I mean, there exist illiberal attitudes and trends within the Czech society and within the Slovak society as well. It's not like Poland and Hungary are all illiberal and we are all liberal. The difference is that in Poland and in Hungary, the governments have a majority which makes them able to legislate and to make policy which policies that the Czechoslovak governments would find you know very very hard to make. And and on Russia, look, I mean, we have a president who's a big fan of Putin and speaks of him as a friend. I mean, fortunately the rest of the country does not, but and there are such politicians in Slovakia, there have always been. So let's not hide the differences under the carpet, but you know, take them in perspective.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks very much. I'm gonna kind of change tack a wee bit. And actually, if you don't mind me bringing in the Brexit question, it hasn't come up in the Q&A, but I'm bound to ask it, aren't I? I'm sitting here in London. I lived in Northern Ireland for a long time, by the way, so watching the events unfold there as a result of Brexit or a particular interpretation of Brexit. And maybe Scotland, who knows where it's going to go in 1 year, 2 years time. I don't know. The fact that I don't know does tell me something about some of the consequences. But I'm very interested in thinking about the consequences of Brexit for the Visegrad Four. And could I put a provocation to you? The Brexit has made the European Union more unified. It's kind of done damage to the Euroscepticism. I mean, if you were a Eurosceptic before Brexit, maybe you become less Eurosceptic now because you can see some of the consequences. Let me say downside consequences, I'm saying at the moment, rather than the positive consequences, which I'm told by my prime minister will follow very, very soon. I'm still waiting. So just pick up on the whole Brexit question. Where do you think that and the impact that's having on the Visegrad for accelerating Euroscepticism, undermining it or whatever? I'll come back to you straight away there, if you don't mind, Mika. And then we can move over straight away. See, I think you wanted to come in on that one very quick.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, I would say two brief observations. And the first, I mean, in the short term, Brexit might have made the EU more united because, you know, there were all these stories of Britain going down to the bottom of the ocean and nobody wants to follow suit, etc., etc. In the medium to long term, I'm afraid the opposite is the case because Europe without Britain is more prone to ideological thinking, to big visions and projects that may turn out not to be successful. We, at least I and many of us in the Czech Republic, we miss the British pragmatism, we miss the dose of common sense, etc., etc. And on the face of it, I mean, you can't, I mean, of course, we are all traumatized by the pandemics, but I think none of us could say that Europe today is more unified than before. I mean, in terms of foreign policy, look at Mr. Borrell's trip to Moscow a couple of or 3 weeks ago. I mean, if that was the sign of European unity, well, I don't know.
Okay, I'm going to bring in Alison here. Unfortunately, Alison, because you don't have a face at the moment, but as you're a Brit yourself, perhaps you want to have a few reflections in answer to my own question, looking at both as a Brit and somebody who really knows that, knows the Visegrad of East Central Europe. What do you think, Alison, about Brexit?
I think it's obviously difficult to say now where we're just a few weeks really into the new situation. The post-Brexit situation, perhaps. But I think Mikhail has grabbed onto something that a lot of people in the UK and outside the UK recognize, which is that the UK brought a certain something to the mix in Brussels, and that certain something, which is British common sense, phlegmatism, good humor, been there before, got plenty of experience running the world, thank you very much. I think there's obviously some expertise that is going to go missing. But what I fear more is that everybody in the on the continent of Europe, as we say in the UK, basically they're prepared to face this situation and they bring a lot of experience to it. I'm not sure that people in the United Kingdom itself have quite so much awareness, particularly when there's a lot of other issues sort of which reflect the lack of unity in UK society. The royal family is one. The population, the popularity of Scottish and other politicians is another. And these are serious things, as you yourself hinted just now. You know, where is this all going to take us? Somewhere quite dramatic, potentially. And I think that, you know, obviously today's students in universities are the ones where a lot of the thinking about what Britain looks like post this phase should be going on.
Yeah, thanks very much, Alison. Vladimir or Peter, just with brief comment on my kind of parochial British question, but it's not quite so parochial, is it really? Vladimir, do you want to go?
I'd like to come in. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Now, my sense is, I'm somebody who spent years in the UK. I was educated partly in the UK, and I was very sorry to see the UK go. But such is the life of democracy. You decided, and I wish you all the best, and I hope also through events and projects such as this one, we can maintain a very strong link. And I hope after the post-Brexit trauma, the link can become even stronger. We need Britain in Europe. We need strong Britain in Europe, and we need strong Europe together with Britain, particularly when it comes to facing Russia, China, but also having a very meaningful relationship across the Atlantic. I think we need this. And that's the fundamental and the bottom line. And we will not be able to manage globally anything unless we do a lot of things together. So I hope there will be a revival of a stronger connection between Brussels and London. Now, in terms of what this has done to the European Union, I remember very much in the post-Brexit trauma for me, you know, when the referendum results were out and we finally knew that Britain would leave and didn't believe it for a long time, that there was a strong debate across a number of states talking about exit. Frexit, you know, remember Marine Le Pen talking about France exiting the European Union before the last presidential elections? She no longer mentions it. You know, I remember even had a discussion about exit in my country, you know, which supported hugely the membership in the European Union. We had a number of debates about exits in different member states. So this is not on the agenda in any pertinent way. It could come back, but I think the European Union, the EU27 have been a lot more cohesive when it comes to any immediate exits. And that's good. That's useful. We've seen that Brexit brings huge costs. I think this is the fundamental and the bottom line. Nobody wants to leave. Now, how long this will last, of course, that also depends on how we'll perform inside the European Union. I think we have a lot of joint tasks ahead. And here I would just like to, as a manner of reaction, maybe mention two sentences. One is on Orbán. I think if somebody does something for at least a decade, it's hardly a tactic. It is a strategy. And I think we should be very careful in terms of how Budapest under Orbán deals with Moscow. I'm saying this as somebody who was vocally critical of Borrell's visit to Moscow. I even signed a letter in the European Parliament calling for Borrell's resignation. And we need to all learn lessons from how to deal with Moscow. I don't think we're doing a very good job here. And again, I think it would be helpful if London and Brussels join forces on some fundamental issues here when it comes to sanctions. Secondly, and this is just a remark to my honorable colleague, Jacek Sarajewski, I don't think there is any such thing as so-called European values. I think in 1956 in Hungary, people stood up for European values. I think the Czech and Slovak dissidents spent time in prison for European values. I think Solidarność was there to fight for European values. I think we are here in the European Union now to make sure that we all live up to European values. And I do believe Visegrad 4, which is not having the best of its times, but it's had great history throughout the 30 years, will be stronger again if we stand up strongly in the name of European, real European values, to which we have all subscribed also by signing the accession agreement. And I think this is important in terms of holding the EU27 together, because there is no other way for us Central Europeans to have influence in this intertwined and more global world unless we work together and unless we subscribe to the same common foundations, which I think have been at the core of the V4. And I agree, we have a lot of common in our region. We have huge friendships across the borders here, and we need to maintain this. But I think fundamentally also there has to be clarity that V4 can be a meaningful contribution to the European project, and I hope we can work even better towards this. Thank you.
Okay. Everybody else had their hand up. I want to kind of ask another question. Jacek, you can come in, and Peter, you can come in on the back of this next question. And if you want to pick up on what's been discussed, and then, you know, take it along. I've asked the Brexit question. I'm now going to ask an American question, because we have been asked to talk about the global order. It seemed to me that when I saw the reaction in most Western capitals, let's take a Berlin or a Paris or a Rome or even a London, the reaction to the election of Joe Biden was very positive, to say the least. And the almost euphoric statements about the going of Donald Trump. Do you think that was reproduced in the Visegrad countries as well? And would that, if it was not, would that not illuminate certain differences? Because I can assure you that I know in London, even amongst those who didn't necessarily, you know, oppose Trump very hard, nonetheless, there was quite, you know, enthusiasm for his departure. And indeed, a great kind of sense of optimism about the transatlantic relationship, with all of you have mentioned as well. So if you want to come in on that, that'll be wonderful. And Jacek, you can go next if you want to pick up on anything else, but also if you could take that second point as well in your remarks. Yeah, Jacek, over to you.
Thank you. Well, to start with America, I think there are differences of sympathies which go across the political spectrum. Generally, the region of Central Eastern Europe is was less hostile to Trump.
Yeah.
Although there are differences, but I would put those differences apart. They do not signify that much, as it's a temporary thing that presidents change and sympathies change. On Orban, to my colleague Bilcik, we are concerned by the Russia policy of Orban, but it's nothing as compared to the CDU, SPD, Nord Stream 2, pro-Russia policy of Germany. No comparison. Its weight is many, many times bigger, and nobody is afraid of being together. I am former vice president of the EPP party and former vice president of the PP group, and I know what I'm saying. What is dangerous is pro-Russian policy of Germany, not Hungary. On Brexit, historical mistake as seen from Central Eastern Europe. Many of us felt betrayed. V4 lost a friend. To quote Rasmussen, former Secretary of NATO, it's weaker EU, weaker NATO, although not at the first glance, but weaker both of them in geopolitical terms. And EU internally much less balanced, institutionally much less balanced. The cohesive forces are weaker. And I don't think that historically it's good to leave the continent without British and with a tandem of French and Germans. And that's a feeling in the region, although probably not in the in every political quarter. So we regret, and we really feel betrayed by Brexit. It didn't have to go that way, and it is a mistake of both sides. It is also, and I've looked on that for nearly 20 years, a lot of mistakes of continental EU that facilitated Farage work, destructive work of this part of the political scene. It could have been saved. It was not. Deep regret. And it is for the British history, it's a historical mistake of the same magnitude as divorce with its former United States colonies. Pete the older. Okay.
Okay.
And you know what I mean.
I think I do. I think the Americans had something to do with that separation as well. Peter, do you want to come in on any of that? And then Michael, I know you wanted to come in because you wanted to bring in on the America. But I want both of you to say something about the United States as well as Brexit. Peter, over to you.
Yeah, thank you. Let me agree with all what was said about the Brexit. I agree. And we miss the UK. The EU was better balanced with the UK in the council, in all the institutions. Concerning the US, I think most people in Hungary welcomed Biden. And well, it was very funny to follow the Twitter diplomacy of Trump, but we trust much more the Syria's actual president. It was interesting to observe that Mr. Orban did not congratulate Biden for several days, and he was among the very last to send a very short formal message. One small illustration, there was a first video meeting of EU foreign ministers with Secretary Blinken, a first meeting with the new US diplomacy. And the Hungarian foreign minister left the room because he had something very urgent to do. And in leaving the room, he gave a short interview saying that in the last 4 years, relations between Hungary and the US were excellent. So this is the attitude of the actual government. I think, let me agree with Vladimir about Putin. I think that, yes, maybe seen from the haze of the whole EU, this relationship between Orban and Putin is not as dangerous as something, some bigger business. But for Hungarians, the fact that Orban is copying Putin in handling the civil organizations, handling my own former university, CEU, which is now partly in Vienna. And in many things, Orban is copy-paste Putin politics implemented in Hungary, this kind of directed democracy, or how to name it in a gentle way. So this is an over-centralized, one-party directed political pattern, which is very much more and more similar to what is happening in Russia.
Thanks, Peter. Strong words, but we hear you. Michael, over to you. And then maybe move to Vladimir again, back to Vladimir. And I've got a question to go.
Michael. On the United States, I think it is the case that Trump was slightly more popular in the V4 countries than in much of the rest of Europe. But I think the explanation has little to do with Trump. I mean, the fact is that the United States is more popular in Central and Eastern Europe than it is in parts of the Western Europe. And that's because the role it played during the Cold War, and that we still remember and very much appreciate. So I think if Sarah Palin became the US president, she would be a little more popular in Central and Eastern Europe than in the rest of Europe. But you know, seriously, I think on Brexit, one more sentence. I hope that a partial realignment between the EU and the United Kingdom will be the goal and the task for the next generation of European and British leaders, because I think it's in the interest of both parts of the channel to do so. But yeah. I'm afraid, and that's the last thing I'm going to say, that the next real challenge for the unity, cohesion of the V4 and of Europe as a whole will not be Russia or the United States, but China. Mm-hmm. And I think that the Belt and Road Initiative that countries of the region, not just the V4 countries, but other countries of the region have various perspectives and approaches to, may be or is becoming a political instrument mm-hmm. that might disrupt the cohesion of the V4 and of Europe as a whole. And I think it's high time to focus on that.
Okay, I actually want to bring in Alison again, so I'm conscious, Alison, because I can't see you, but just to bring you in on a question which is also posed at the very end there by Michael about China. Do you have any views about that? Because it seems to me, you know, this is the elephant in the room, if I might use the term elephant to describe China, which is not entirely appropriate, I know, but it should be a panda, obviously, or something like that. But Alison, do you get the sense that this emerging great power is going to have more and more influence over the V4, Alison? And do you think that's going to be to the good or to the ill? And do you think this is going to unite or divide the Visegrad countries? Alison, what do you think? And if others want to pick up on that, I'd be appreciate your comments as well. Alison, over to you.
Okay, thank you for giving me this opportunity to pronounce on what is really a large, huge question, which is not answerable in the next few minutes. But I think we can look at, for instance, what has happened to Hong Kong to see that things are changing in and around China. You have a leader who is clearly confident and feels that he can make moves that 10 years ago would have been considered perhaps unmakeable. Mm. And I think that a lot of people with greater experience of that region than I seem to say that Hong Kong itself, which, as we know, those of us who've lucky enough to have visited there, is a very special place. It sort of combined a great deal of British know-how and many colonializing instincts, which we might question more now, with Chinese ingenuity and ability to make things work. And it's an extremely special place, Hong Kong. But it has been quite changed over the last 2 years. It is very clear that demonstrations are unwelcome. And it is pretty clear that Beijing will be able to decide what it wants to have happen there. So I think what that says as a message to Europe is, let's get thinking really hard, really fast about what we're going to do. I find it interesting that the only sort of serious academic think tank about 5 years ago in Berlin on this, it was a lone think tank on China. Mm. Things have sped up quite a bit since then, but perhaps not fast enough. Mm. So I would say we should all keep a very wary eye out.
Okay. I think I'll stick with the China theme because we're at 25 minutes past and I know that we get cut off very, very quickly. So I do want some very, I wouldn't say one sentence answers on the China question, but it's the big looming question. It is going to be the fundamental driver, that relationship with the United States as well as with the EU over the next 50 years. Let's be honest about it. Maybe Russia is an immediate problem, but the longer term question is always going to be about China, given the growth of its economy, its confidence and its history. Why don't I go down the line and go back to the very beginning? I want an answer on China from each very, very quickly, if I may. Vladimir, good thing, bad thing? It's coming. Nothing we can do.
We have to deal with China. I'm very pleased that yesterday in our EPP, European People's Party group, we actually agreed to a strategic paper on China. I invite everybody to read it. Yep. We actually have a position on that. I don't think we can face China alone in Europe. I think we need the Americans back in business. Unfortunately, Trump disengaged. I do hope Biden re-engages and also re-engages with us on China. Okay. And I hope London re-engages as well, and we can really face China together. This is important. I am extremely concerned about what China is doing, not just in the European Union, sure, but in our neighborhood, especially in the Western Balkans. China is playing a very smart game, less visibly so. But we really have to face China, and politically, it's going to be probably the biggest challenge of the coming decades.
Which is why I wanted it. We wanted to address it right at the very end in a session on global order. Peter, what are your very, very quick thoughts on that? Moving then over to Jacek and Michael.
EU hasn't been strong enough to coordinate the action of its member states, so they run everybody to the 17 plus one meetings without real EU coordination. Now, the new US administration is definitely stronger, and we could see the first impact of some US influence rebalancing. Perhaps the transatlantic family together, EU and US, can counterbalance China and have a right and correct deal with Beijing.
Thank you, Peter. Michael, very quickly. Vladimir, quickly. And Jacek, very quickly.
Yeah. Very quick. You know, specifically, I'm interested in the question whether and how much the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative will interact and possibly interfere with the Three Seas Initiative, which is a regional initiative that concerns us all.
We'll have to wait and see. Jacek, over to you for the very last point.
Thank you. I mean, the level of Chinese economic penetration of Central Eastern Europe region is minimal as compared to Western Europe. So we have plenty of space still to catch up and to act within this 1+17 format. Second, we are very, very worried by the unilateral German CHI agreement replacing true EU position on that. Very, very worried. It's a copy of Russia policy, and it's very, very dangerous. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to draw it all to a close now. We've only got 60 seconds or less left. Firstly, to thank all of our speakers here today, Vladimir, Peter, Jacek, Alison, and Michael. I think we've had a great discussion. Good to hear that you're missing the UK. I can equally say to you that I'm missing all of you at the same time. I'd like to say thank you to all the people at LSE Ideas who have made this possible. Megan, I'd like to say thank you to the Polish Cultural Institute here in London. I hope that we can have more discussion in the future. And all I want to say now is thank you, goodbye, keep well, and do keep safe. So goodbye to everybody, and have a good week and have a good year, and a better year than 2020, I think we would all pray for as well. So thanks again, everybody. Bye-bye.